you. So when I was preparing this talk, I thought that I wanted to start by thinking about a few examples of what racism looks like in our society today. And unfortunately, it wasn't that hard to find a few examples, actually. And you could look at the appalling treatment by the Australian government of refugees and asylum seekers on Manus and Nauru, and in Australia more widely, or the treatment of Muslims and their failure to integrate properly, stereotyping Muslim men as violent terrorists, using their uncivilised culture to subjugate Muslim women, who are in turn stereotyped as passive victims, meek and lacking any agency. And that's without even getting to the rise of the far right and right-wing nationalists in governments and on the streets around the world. Here in Australia, far-right politicians like the actual Nazi, Fraser Anning, Pauline Hanson and Mark Latham are gaining more and more traction. But they are not outliers, somehow representing something un-Australian with their rhetoric. They're echoing and building on what they hear from the mouths of politicians and media outlets every day, like Scott Morrison whipping up fears over Muslim immigration, or the supposed Labour left, Wollongong MP Stephen Jones, saying homophobia is the price you pay for multiculturalism in the wake of the Israel-Falau affair. As the historian Marilyn Lake asked in the aftermath of the Cronulla riots in 2005, what is un-Australian about calling for racial exclusion in the name of the nation? Is not racial exclusion a deep part of our heritage, as traditional an Australian value as mateship? Australia as a country began with white supremacy at its very heart, with the genocide of the oldest continuous civilization on the planet, and continues to deny its existence and the impact of that genocide on the lives of Aboriginal people today. So it seems like every few years there's a new form of racism to fight. And despite the fury of people across the world, it's easy to feel like the fight against racism is futile, that we'll never win. And this is because the ruling class will always use racism to divide us and allow minorities to be used as scapegoats for the problems they themselves create, and they change the way they use racism to fit with the times. But Marxists have something very particular to offer in the fight against racism, because we understand that what is socially rooted can be socially uprooted. We can see that the fight against racism lies with the majority of ordinary people recognising the function that racism has under capitalism and can decide they won't stand for it anymore. They do that through the process of struggle. Every time they stand up for their non-white co-worker or school friend or stranger on the bus, they undermine the capitalists and their need for division among ordinary people. So I think it's important to start off by saying that racism hasn't always existed. Now, there are contradictory arguments about racism. The common explanations we hear are that either it's inherent to human nature and therefore it will always exist, or we live in some kind of post-racial society. Or if it does exist, that it's just from a few bad apples who need better education or training. Or actually, the real problem is white people and their privilege and their unconscious biases. But if it was inherent to human nature, we would see it throughout history. And this simply isn't the case. Ancient Greek and Roman civilizations certainly had their prejudices, but it wasn't on the basis of a person's skin colour. They certainly had a slave society, but there was no visible marker to identify a slave. As C.L.R. James writes, historically, it is pretty well proved that the ancient Greeks and Romans knew nothing about race. They had another standard, civilized and barbarian. And you could have white skin and be barbarian, and you could be black and be civilized. You could be white and be a slave, or be black and be a Roman emperor. Toni Morrison, the wonderful African-American writer who died recently, said, "There's no such thing as race, none. There is just the human race. Scientifically, anthropologically, racism is a construct, a social construct." And she's absolutely right. Scientifically, there are more genetic variations within so-called races than there are between them. So if there's no such thing as race, what do we mean by racism? So my definition of racism, and people can disagree or come up with other definitions in the discussion or whatever, but my definition is where an entire group of people are systematically oppressed and discriminated against on the basis of assumed shared characteristics. And they usually share those characteristics based on their skin colour, although not exclusively, if you look at anti-Irish racism, for example. But it's also about power and oppression, when you have the power to change the course of someone's life due to their race. So there's no such thing as reverse racism. As Malcolm X said, if we react to white racism with a violent reaction, to me, that's not black racism. If you come to put a rope around my neck and I hang you for it, to me, that's not racism. Yours is racism, but my reaction has nothing to do with racism. So where does the racism as we have come to understand it come from? Peter Fryer, in his collection of speeches, Aspects of Black British History, says racism has had a precise social function under capitalism, as an ideology to justify the exploitation and domination of people. So we see racism arise with the development of capitalism. And I think that understanding the rise of capitalism and the transatlantic slave trade in particular is key to understanding the development of racism, a particular form of exploitation. This month, August 2019, marks the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the first documented black enslaved people to the British colony of Virginia in what would become the southern states of the US, having been captured from Angola on the west coast of Africa. We've had 400 years of the ruling class trying to use race in different ways to justify the exploitation of people so they can make lots of money. Trinidadian historian Eric Williams, in his seminal text, Capitalism and Slavery, talks about how British capitalism relied on the slave trade to cement its domination across the world. They grew cotton and sugar in its colonies and then brought these products back to Britain to fuel its industrial demands. Cities like Liverpool, Bristol, and Manchester were literally built on the backs of slave labour. Eric Williams puts it like this: Britain's mechanised might was making the whole world her footstool. She was clothing the world, exporting men and machines, and had become the world's banker. He talks at length about British capitalism and its rapid expansion. British cotton imports rose from £11 million in 1784 to £283 million in 1832, less than 50 years. In the space of 64 years, the American colony had gone from providing 0.01% to 80% of Britain's cotton. The planters in America and the Caribbean needed to keep up with the pace, and their reliance on indigenous and white workers wasn't keeping up with demand. So the planters needed labour, so they came up with the idea of using people from their other colonies in Africa to make up for the labour shortage. Here's Williams again. Here, then, is the origin of Negro slavery. The reason was economic, not racial. It had to do not with the colour of the labourer, but the cheapness of the labour. The features of the man, his hair, colour, dentifrice, his subhuman characteristics so widely pleaded, were only the later rationalisations to justify a simple economic fact, that the colonies needed labour and resorted to Negro labour because it was cheapest and best. This was not a theory, it was a practical conclusion deduced from the previous experience of the planter. He would have gone to the moon, if necessary, for labour. Africa was nearer than the moon, nearer too than the more populous countries of India and China, but their turn was to come. It is commonly assumed that white supremacy drove slavery, but in fact it was the other way around. As Williams puts it, slavery was not born of racism, rather racism was the consequence of slavery. Its purpose was to ideologically justify and help maintain an extremely profitable system of unfree labour. They literally invent and create a reason why they are allowed to treat black people in this way. In his wonderful book, The Black Jacobins, C.L.R. James writes, "The Negroes," says a memoir published in 1789, "are unjust, cruel, barbarous, half-human, treacherous, deceitful, thieves, drunkards, proud, lazy, unclean, shameless, jealous to fury, and cowards." It was by sentiments such as these that they strove to justify the abominable cruelties they practiced. These opinions were absolutely essential to the continued repression of black people, but was also important to stop their resistance. They kept rebelling on the plantations, robbing and sometimes killing their masters, or running away entirely. Enslaved people resisted during the passage on ships to Africa, to the Caribbean or the American colonies, resisted on the plantations, and continued to resist until they were free. C.L.R. James talks about the hundreds of slave rebellions that happened on plantations and says, "The only place the Negroes did not revolt is in the pages of the capitalist historians." In other words, they've been completely written out of history. And they were written out of history in order to dehumanise them. If they have no agency, no ideas, no personhood, white people would find it harder to stand in solidarity with them, to join forces and fight for better conditions. The plantation owners faced a double threat from the enslaved Africans and the majority of whites who belonged to the labouring classes too. If black and white labour lived and worked together, they could also resist together. So they needed racism to keep them divided. The white poor were given the idea of superiority simply due to their whiteness in order to mitigate against their poorness so they would feel a kinship with the white rulers. White people were led to think they had a stake in the system, as they appeared to be materially better off than black people with new laws allowing legal discrimination purely on the basis of race. And there were somewhat successful attempts made to get them identified with the white ruling class. The abolitionist Frederick Douglass writes, "The hostility between the whites and blacks of the South is easily explained. It has its root and sap in the relation of slavery and was incited on both sides by the cunning of the slave masters. Those masters secured their ascendancy over both the poor whites and the blacks by putting enmity between them. They divided both to conquer each." The ruling class also invented 128 categories of mulatto, of people with mixed race heritage, which in turn determined rights. So if you had a certain amount of black in you, you could own a certain amount of land, you could live in certain places, you could have certain jobs. But it was a pure creation, used to control both the black slave population as well as the mixed race people themselves. They would begin to identify somewhat with the plantation owners rather than the slaves. It's interesting to see, though, how these things are adapted. Later, in the Jim Crow South of the US, if you had one drop of black blood in you, you were considered entirely black by law and legally discriminated against. And now, here in Australia, Pauline Hanson's One Nation will only accept full-blood Aboriginal people as deserving rights or reparations, calling for Aboriginal tests to determine whether they should be allowed what they see as certain privileges of claiming Aboriginal ancestry. But surely this was just representative of the bigotry that dominated society at the time. Well, even figures from the Enlightenment period, people with otherwise progressive ideas, fell into the traps that the system set for them. Sometimes people are surprised by this, by the idea that someone like Thomas Jefferson, for example, who wrote the US Declaration of Independence, could write in that document, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." That he could write that and be a slave owner. Gender politics aside, this was a radical statement for the time. Like Jefferson, others who threw around phrases inspired by the French Revolution, like equality, fraternity, and liberty, justified racism because they financially benefited from the slave trade. Ideas of racial superiority were explained and justified on a pseudo-scientific basis. Sure, all men are created equal, but black people aren't people. They're nothing like us, their brains aren't like ours, and so on. But despite the so-called progressives of the day using the same rhetoric as the ruling class, there was always resistance to the barbarity of the slave trade. Anti-racism has existed as long as racism has. And while it was difficult for the abolitionist movement to gain traction because slavery was such an integral part of the way society functioned, they kept going. The abolition movement in Britain was the first mass movement of its kind, which pioneered all the techniques of campaigning that we still use today. Mass leafleting, the use of powerful images, the idea of wearing a badge, fly posting, speaking tours, and so on. They led a movement that made ordinary people see what really lay behind the sugar they ate, the tobacco they smoked, the coffee they drank, and organised boycotts of products grown on slave plantations. They gathered the biggest number of petitions ever sent to Parliament in its history. And all this took place in a country whose empire was economically reliant on the slave trade. This mass movement was responsible for changing an entire country's opinion on a subject that brought so much prosperity to the country. The slogan of the abolition movement was, "A Negro is a man and my brother." This was a huge statement to make at the time. Manchester alone collected 10,000 signatures. That's one for every five people in the city. Later, when the issue of slavery was one of the main reasons for the start of the American Civil War, Marx and Engels and other committed socialists made sure that the burgeoning labour movement in the UK supported the North, despite the fact that their own jobs were in industries that relied on slave labour. They were able to pass motions of support for the North based on the ideas of justice and solidarity, with Marx saying, "Labour with a white skin cannot be free while labour with a black skin is in chains." So, why didn't racism end with the abolition of slavery if it was developed simply as a means to justify slavery? If the slave trade was central to the development of racism, then imperialism is central to its continued perpetuation. We can see this with the expansion of the British Empire through colonisation in the 19th century. In order to justify their rule over millions of people on the Indian subcontinent and from there elsewhere in Asia and Africa, they used the same racist lies, just told in a slightly different way. They used paternalism, the idea that they were like children, simply incapable of looking after themselves, but it was just another way of dehumanising them. And we see similar paternalistic attitudes today. with the bombing of Afghanistan and Iraq, supposedly justified, if you believe the likes of Condoleezza Rice and Hillary Clinton, on the basis of freeing these poor, oppressed women from the horrors of patriarchal Islam. And we see similar rhetoric used about protecting Aboriginal people, Aboriginal women and children from domestic violence and child abuse as justification for the unprecedented rate of child removals during the Northern Territory intervention, as well as more recently. The fact that they had to suspend the Racial Discrimination Act in order to carry out the intervention tells you they knew exactly what they were doing with that strategy. Under capitalism, borders do not stand in the way of capital, but they certainly stand in the way of the people that want to follow that capital. Again, we see capitalism adapting its use of racism. So the new enemy are migrants. Despite the ruling class actually creating this problem in the pursuit of profits, it's the immigrants who are somehow simultaneously the ones taking all the jobs, as well as being dole bludgers. All sorts of people can fall for the nationalism that gets whipped up around these kinds of questions. We see it with the trade unions sometimes calling for Aussie jobs for Aussie workers, as well as others with perhaps more left-wing credentials. Perhaps not, though. People may have seen the stuff around Clive Hamilton from the Greens, who and his book called Silent Invasion, talking about China's dark influence over Australian politics. As Australian imperialism comes under threat from China, the ruling class will stop at nothing to make us fear and hate China, the Chinese people, and the 1.2 million people of Chinese descent living in Australia, just like the population was urged to hate the Germans and Japanese during previous imperialist wars. But everything has to be driven into the hearts and minds of people. There's nothing natural about people hating black or Aboriginal people, or hating Chinese people as the ones responsible for the supposed threat to the nation, or hating Muslims for their supposed threat to the Western way of life. To paraphrase something one of our comrades said in one of her talks at Marxism earlier this year, if racism is so natural, why do they have to work so bloody hard to make it sick? Because racism comes from the top of society, we see them having to put so much effort in to make sure that racism thrives among those at the bottom. So what do Marxists say about fighting racism today? As much as challenging everyday occurrences of racism matters, and matters a lot, any serious fight against racism has to go beyond the individual and must have a serious critique of capitalism, because it's the system of capitalism that's destroying us, I mean, literally in the case of the planet. Towards the end of his life, Martin Luther King said, "I've come upon something that disturbs me deeply. We fought hard and long for integration, as I believe we should have, and I know that we will win. But I've come to believe we're integrating into a burning house." We know it's not possible to get rid of capitalism without working class unity, breaking down the divisions this rotten system creates and that the ruling class exploits. So any fight against capitalism has to have anti-racism at its heart. Racism mutates in response to the challenges that it faces from people from below. An important tool in this mutation is the racialisation of crime in the UK, in the US and Australia, with things like Operation Trident, a police operation in the UK that was set up to investigate so-called black-on-black crime, the whole war on drugs in the US, about which the people directly involved have confirmed that it was in fact a war on black people, or the domination of media headlines creating hysteria about African gangs that even the Victorian police had to tell them to scale back on because it simply wasn't true. Since the 1800s in the US, prisons became the vessels for Americans' anxieties about crime and the people who supposedly commit that crime. As the fear of black people spread at the end of the Civil War, imprisonment became a weapon of controlling their entire community. And it's always useful to have this kind of permanent scapegoat. So I came to Australia nearly 4 years ago. Hooray. And in that time, the following incidents have made the headlines. Fraser Anning calling for a final solution on immigration. 100% of youth detainees in the Northern Territory are Indigenous. The murder of a 14-year-old boy, Elijah Doughty, who was run over by a man who believed that Elijah had stolen his motorbike. The arrest of an Aboriginal woman, Aileen Roy, for being drunk in her own home. Pauline Hanson, again, accusing Muslim men of having multiple wives and multiple children in order to defraud Centrelink. Breakfast show, Sunrise, casually talking about starting another stolen generation because Aboriginal people apparently can't look after their own children. And New South Wales Labour leader Michael Daly saying that young Australian people are moving out of Sydney and are being replaced by Asians who are moving in and taking their jobs. Remind me why we moved to Australia again. Some of this stuff happens so casually, so frequently, that I think we forget to notice that it's just plain racism. And racism is a tool that doesn't just impact people of colour in today's society, but also white people. So in the southern states of the United States, where the area of the country which has the most entrenched racism, it also has the lowest wages and the lowest levels of unionisation, showing that white people do not, in fact, materially benefit from racism. And this is not a new phenomenon. In 1870, Karl Marx described the working class in England as divided into two hostile camps, the English and the Irish. And he called this the secret of the impotence of the English working class. Marx recognised how these divisions were artificially kept alive and intensified by the press, the pulpit, the comic papers, in short, by all the means at the disposal of the ruling class, which is the secret by which the capitalist class maintains its power, and that class is fully aware of it. Sounds familiar, I think. And he knew, just as Marxists today know, that the English working class back then had to be at the forefront of the struggle for Irish independence if it was ever to become a revolutionary force in the fight against capitalism. Now, racism today might look very different from how it looked 20, 50 or 100 years ago. There isn't the same level of verbal abuse or racist attacks in the street or overt discrimination in employment or housing, but the same systematic and structural discrimination remains. And the ruling class continues to use racism in more subtle ways to drive its insatiable quest for profits by using things like the argument of scarcity to divide people. In the recent New South Wales state election, both Labour and Liberals called for a pause on immigration as hospitals and transport apparently weren't up to the job. Now, rather than admitting that they weren't up to the job because successive governments had failed to invest in them properly, and since losing the unlosable federal election, the ALP started saying that they were unsuccessful because they weren't tougher on immigration or because they were losing the religious right in Western Sydney because of their position on marriage equality. Classic divide and rule. Instead of addressing the things that ordinary people say they want to radically improve their lives, they decided to blame ordinary people and divide them even more. But you know, this tactic doesn't always work. People see through it time and time again. They see past their differences and focus on the real enemy, whether that's in anti-racist struggles, the massive Invasion Day rallies, or the solidarity shown to the Muslim community in the wake of the terrorist attack in Christchurch earlier this year. So, to start wrapping up, I came across this lovely quote from Peter Fryer, and he says, "It must never be forgotten that the ruling class did not hand over civil liberties to the working class on a plate. The working class had to struggle for them, and that struggle was long, hard, and bitter. Our civil liberties were won in struggle by men and women who had the guts to endure vilification, arrest, imprisonment, and transportation, and face even the prospect of execution. Let us do all we can to make sure that their tradition and their contribution are never forgotten." For socialists, our aim is to build movements that challenge racism and to fight on the bread and butter issues that affect black and white workers alike. By working together and following the footsteps of some of the movements that have gone before us, we can begin to build the sort of society we want. In the age of the rise of the far right, the reinforcement of borders, the new concentration camps on the southern border of the US, now more than ever, we need the politics of resistance, hope and solidarity. Ordinary people have won victories in the past, in the campaign to abolish the slave trade, the campaign for civil rights in the US and Australia, the campaign for marriage equality. This is the tradition we stand in, and it's from the shoulders of the activists who came before us that we can see the possibility and the necessity of another world, a world free from exploitation, capitalism and war, a world of true liberation for everyone. Thanks.